At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This week on Unforgotten.
Last time on Unforgotten, we introduced you to Stephen Pearson.
I can tell you his security wire was cut for his security.
They admitted the package did arrive, and they admitted that it contained marijuana.
A Grand Bay resident found a car deep in the woods behind her home on Henderson Farms Road.
And we all had came to the same conclusion that it was staged.
And both Bowman seemed to believe what happened to him was directly tied to the package.
The people have come to them and they're like, we're getting this package back one way or another. They could form a logical assumption that the people looking for the package could have had something to do with it.
By December 28th, Stephen was officially reported missing.
The day after that visit of the postmaster, when next day Stephen disappeared. And then I don't believe in coincidences.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
And now for Season 2, Episode 5, Stephen Pearson, Part 2.
Hey, guys, and welcome back.
Hey, Sellers. How's it going?
How you doing?
It's been quite a few days, and I don't mean quite a few, I mean quite a few days.
You got a lot going on.
Oh, you just, yeah. Having an elderly mom is an adventure.
How did the false alarm get triggered today?
So she wore to bed, so it's a, you know, like a pendant around your neck.
Mm-hmm.
She got up at one point. She does that kind of like usually wee hours of the morning, but she got up a little earlier than normal, went out, got coffee, whatever, went back to bed. She must have been twisting because she turns a heck of a lot when she's like in bed. And she said it felt like it was choking her. So she was like trying to get it off of her neck. I don't know if it got caught in her nightgown or the sheets or whatever. And she must have yanked it really hard.
Mm.
And I don't know what she did with it. She threw it on the floor or she set it on the table or what she did with it. I don't have any idea. And she was just about to fall asleep when she saw flashing lights kind of, you know, against the wall in the hall. And she was trying to figure out what it was. And about that time, this great big guy was standing in her hallway.
Oh, my God.
Dearie, are you okay? He was super nice to her. And fortunately, she wasn't like all the way asleep because she probably would have been petrified.
Yeah.
But, you know, but yeah. Apparently, you have to remember these things. When you do something new like this, always make sure to check that you're, like if you have silence on your phone, that it's programmed in as one of those names that you let ring through.
Oh, God.
Because all 4 people on this, well, I shouldn't say that actually. One of the people actually heard it, but there was no answer on the other line. So something was wrong with her phone. But so she didn't know who it was and just let it go. But the rest of us, nobody heard the call. My brother woke up to get ready for work and saw the messages and called me.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I was sure my mom would never wear that thing again, but she actually said it was actually a really great, they were really nice, and it's nice to know that it works, and that, you know, now we know how it works.
Wasn't exactly the test where you're planning on, but you know, agreed, at least you know that it works. Man, that would have freaked me out though if I just was a random person inside my house.
I know. And probably had there not been the flashing lights, maybe it would have been more scary. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the worst about having my phone go on do not disturb at a certain time, like it automatically clicks it over. And so I try to add anybody that I think would be, you know, trying to get through to me that I would need to answer those calls.
Yeah.
It's great for like giving you that boundary to create like your me time or stop all the notifications and stuff. But at the same time, it's like, oh gosh, dang.
Yeah.
Can't, like get, there's no way to get everybody that could possibly need through.
Right.
Well, I guess y'all got that fixed now, huh?
Yep. We certainly do.
Yeah.
Didn't even occur to me. You know, it's just like one of those things, you know, a person, you know, like a family member. Yeah. Probably if I was setting, but it just didn't even cross my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think there are any announcements, or at least none that come to mind right
Nope. now. Nope. I just appreciate everybody giving us a little bit of leeway to take a little time for summer. So,
yes. I mean, it's been, work's been crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We've been busy, even though the podcast hadn't been out.
Right.
So it's just, I feel like I'm always on the road somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I did just get a new car. So that's better.
Yes. And it's super a pretty excited. Car.
It is. I'm super excited about that. So now maybe I can travel a little bit better. Because mine was getting on up there in miles. And the air conditioner decided that it was going to start going on the fritz. So that has since been repaired. But Aiden's actually driving it right now because his truck is in the shop getting painted. So that worked
reasons.
Out.
Reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's a plenty good reason to get a new car. I think it'd take less reasons than that for me to do it.
I know. I'm super excited about it. Because, I mean, I haven't had a new car in years. So, and the one that I had was well over 10 years old. So, it was
well deserved.
It was time for an upgrade. So,
yeah. Alrighty.
So, jumping right on in. Last time on Unforgotten, we introduced you to Stephen Pearson, a father, a friend, and a man known for quietly showing up when others needed him.
He would treat me like a princess. I was his daughter. He was my daddy, but he was also my best friend. I could talk to him about anything without judgment. He was my daddy.
As far as you know, Stephen had no enemies.
Not that we were able to find out.
Sounds like from the...
I mean, he was very neighborly. Yeah. You know, everybody knew one another. He was well-liked at work.
Always showed up.
He was out for a promotion.
Yeah.
You know, after the Christmas holidays.
He was out for 2 weeks, and then we've got his supervisor saying, you know, he stopped in and out, you know, a couple times chatting with people. In the days leading up to his disappearance, Stephen wasn't acting like himself. He was restless, scattered, making strange financial moves, handing out gifts, which that might not be so out of the ordinary given that it was Christmas time, and telling people things at the time that felt like jokes.
But those jokes didn't sound so funny once he vanished. By December 28th, Stephen was officially reported missing. He'd called in a break-in, dropped warnings to friends and neighbors, and left behind a trail of brief phone calls and unexplained behavior.
And, you know, his behavior was weird. It was very kind of manic and off and edgy, testy, irritable, unlike Dad. Dad was usually, I mean, everybody liked Dad. you know, so it was very odd. I know Dad had gotten like $5,000 or $10,000 cash from doing this bank something, something, something. I don't remember all the details. And I have never been able to track where, like, that the money was deposited anywhere, but that it seemed like he had the cash. So he would have disappeared, presumably, with a fair amount of money on him. So stopping at the ATM doesn't make a lot of sense either.
And then there was the Impala, found abandoned in the woods.
It didn't look like the end of a road. It looked like a setup.
And just before everything spiraled, Stephen told the postmaster that he'd delivered a package to his neighbors, the Bowmans.
A package they claim they never received.
And so my dad thought it was a Christmas package of sorts. And so he signed for it and was like, I'll take it over to them. Maybe they're out of town or whatever, not realizing all of the above that would ensue thereafter.
In this episode, we're going deeper into that delivery and into the family at the center of it. Because when Stephen talked about leaving, he said it was out of fear of conflict with family and of what might happen if he stayed.
Was Stephen trying to get away from something? Or did someone silence him before he could say what he knew?
We sat down with Mobile County Sheriff Paul Birch to get his thoughts on Stephen's disappearance and what made him key in on the Bowmans early on.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
All right, so tell me your name.
Paul Burke. Currently, I'm the sheriff of Mobile County, Alabama.
How long had you been working whenever you got this case?
That case was in December of 2000. I've been in law enforcement since 1989.
This is the only one that you still got hanging
out there? It is the only unsolved case that I have. And I've worked dozens upon dozens of homicide cases.
What do you think makes this one so difficult?
The fact that we, you know, have a strong belief of who killed Stephen Pearson, but we don't have anything to prove it, and we don't have a body. There were a number of neighbors who complained about Bowman killing people's pets around that.
Like the older one or the younger one?
Little Bowman.
And he stayed in trouble a lot, because I found a federal case for him where his name was Spider.
Yeah.
That's what he went by. What makes you think they would have done it outside of the fact that he had a criminal record? Because, like, making drugs doesn't necessarily equate to murder.
I can tell you they were extremely afraid of going to prison for the marijuana that they received. And Stephen, you know, obviously was really upset that he had delivered marijuana unknowingly and immediately went to the postmaster when he found out that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And it was the day after that visit of the postmaster, when the postmaster went to talk to the Bowmans, next day Stephen disappeared. And then I don't believe in coincidences. If you look at it in the sense that, okay, Stephen just came and told us that he went and reported us to law enforcement, and now we've got a problem, and you know, we're going to eliminate that problem.
In the last episode, we left you with a narrative from the missing person report filed on December 28th, 2000. It read as follows. The reporting party, Julie Pearson, stated that the last time anyone saw her father, Stephen Pearson, was on the morning of December 27, 2000. Stephen was the victim of a burglary at his residence, 11185 King Bird Road. Deputy Law responded and was possibly the last person to see him. The burglary complaint was S00121306. Julie received word from the office of Dr. Creighton, where Stephen is being treated for manic depression, that Stephen was especially delusional,
they advised Julie to keep an eye on him. On the morning of December 28, 2000, Julie went to her father's home to check on him. She found that Stephen was not there. Concerned, she began driving the area looking for him. She found Sergeant Colvin on McClinton Road and reported the incident. Julie states that Stephen has mentioned to her that there are snipers in the trees around his home. He also told her that he may shoot her son. Dr. Creighton's office treats Stephen with lithium, which Julie claims he has not been taking. She also states he likes to consume alcoholic beverages and may be driving around in an intoxicated condition. Julie says Stephen is probably not a threat to others, but may be harmful to himself. Deputy Law stated that Stephen has a blue Chevrolet Impala station wagon, which was not on the scene while Julie was there this morning. Stephen mentioned that he likes to go to the casinos in Mississippi. The possibility exists that Stephen drove his Impala there. Julie states that Stephen works at Ingalls Shipyard. She has checked there, as well as area hospitals and the homes of Stephen's friends, but cannot find him. Julie is currently staying in an area motel. Her cell phone number is William Pearson is Stephen's brother. His phone number is because Stephen is a mental patient, he was entered into NCIC as missing.
And next thing you know, Dad's calling, placing a breaking and entering. I can tell you his security wire was cut for his security system. And Dad was gone. Dad called me. Dad, you know, then called Lucy, my now dead mother-in-law. And supposedly he went to the casinos and was on video withdrawing money from the ATM, which makes no sense because Dad should have had, from the best we've been able to piece together, somewhere between, and I don't remember the exact amount, but somewhere between like $5,000 and $10,000 cash on him.
9 days later, on January 6th, 2001, at approximately 1:30 p.m., a Grand Bay resident, Peggy Denniston, called the Mobile County Sheriff's Office. She'd found a car deep in the woods behind her home on Henderson Farms Road.
Do you remember how the lady that reported it found it?
Well, it was on her property, and then they were, you know, walking their property and discovered it.
And it didn't appear stuck. It appeared more like it had been left there, deliberately. They don't mention in that original report anything about the red blazer. But I did ask about that, and we've asked Julie about it. And my understanding is that the red blazer was actually still at Stephen's house. So the Impala was not, but the blazer was.
Gotcha.
And they don't reference that in the missing person report, but my understanding is it was at his house.
That's good to know. Yeah. Because there's a lot of questions about the cars. The official incident report reads, at approximately 1330 hours on 6 January 2001, I was dispatched to 111190 Henderson Farms Road, Grand Bay, Alabama, in reference to a car in the woods. At that location, met with complainant. Preliminary investigation revealed that a blue 1979 Chevrolet Impala station wagon bearing Alabama tags 2CM8958 was parked unattended in a wooded area of complainant's property. After making contact with this vehicle, it was noticed to have miscellaneous items in it such as a TV, BB gun, sleeping bag, etc. in it. No one else was around this vehicle. A tag check resulted in no information on file. A checkbook with the above subject's name on it, Stephen Pearson, was found inside the vehicle. I tried to call that number. However, I could not get an answer. A check also was made at subject's residence that resulted in no contact. Because of no verification of the vehicle's owner and no confirmation that the above vehicle is listed as stolen, this case is listed as trespassing by vehicle 13A-7-4-1. At approximately 19:30 hours on 6 January 2001, William Pearson called me. William Pearson is Stephen Pearson's brother. William stated that a missing person report was filed on subject on 12/28/2000. Notifications were made through SO Command concerning this incident. So because the tag resulted in no information on file and no contact was made with Stephen to confirm the vehicle belonged to him, the report was filed under trespassing by vehicle.
You know, it's interesting because later when we get into the narrative from Sheriff Birch, he says the vehicle was registered to Stephen. And so I'm not really sure why it didn't initially come back, like what the deal was with that tag and why it didn't initially come back to Stephen Pearson. But presumably because the officer said he called the number, I'm guessing he left a message, and maybe that's why, how Bill Pearson knew to give him a call.
Could be.
Because otherwise, how would he know that the car was found, you know?
Yeah.
So my guess is that he left a message on an answering machine, and maybe Bill was checking it and called and said, hey, we filed a missing person report.
Yeah, that would be a logical conclusion. Yeah, that's... It does leave it kind of questionable as to how he would know, but yeah, you're right. It very well could be that, yeah.
So the tag came back with no information on file, according to the report. They tried to contact Stephen. No answer. Deputies even tried to stop by his home, and there was no one there. The same Impala he'd purchased less than a month earlier, the same one he'd given Don Dixon the paperwork to just a few days before he vanished. That's what they find in the woods. Like, is that not bizarre?
Very bizarre. There were no signs of a struggle, no blood, no fingerprints, and, of course, no Stephen.
Which makes it even more bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, so, someone wiped that down.
Right.
Like, not like the car just drove itself there.
Yeah, absolutely. As if somebody really just took a rag and, like, wiped the whole thing down.
And it stays in a way that someone would maybe think that the person went missing from that location. Mm-hmm. And it was maybe camping, whatever. It was parked in the woods, you know, obviously not occupied. You know, there was a lot of experience, law enforcement-wise, out there. People have been doing it much longer than me. And we all had the same, came to the same conclusion that it was staged out mm-hmm. there. You know, seats and buckets kind of just sitting, and, you know, the door was open, and just it was clearly a staged scene.
And, you know, you kind of think, like, okay, well, he was kind of having some kind of mental episode, it sounds like, from different things. But would he have thought through, I guess, if you're paranoid?
I was just going to say, yeah.
Peggy Denniston's property sat just 4 miles from the homes of both Stephen and the Bowmans, if you actually took the roadways. But if you just walked out Stephen's back door to Peggy's house, it was less than a mile as the crow flies. Like, it basically just made a big square. Like, it was almost a perfect square, actually, when I mapped it out on Google. Mm-hmm. Like, you have the top of the square, the left side of the square, the bottom of the square, and the only thing that was missing was the right side.
Wow.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's really close when you look at it. And then...
Could you see any way that a vehicle could get through in that direction? Or,
well, it's wooded, and then it's also, I mean, there's woods, and then there's fields. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I don't...
Probably not.
I wouldn't think so, but maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're local to the area, you know different ways to get places, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when I asked Sheriff Birch about it, you know, what is this something where, like, anybody could have just been like, oh, here, we'll just stick a vehicle over here? Or is it something like you needed to be local to know how to get there? And he said, oh, that's definitely somewhere that locals would know.
Right. With the discovery of the vehicle and the missing person report now linked, the search began.
According to Sheriff Birch's narrative, the area around Henderson Farms Road was combed by deputies, K-9 teams from the Atmore prison, News 5's helicopter, and over 35 Grand Bay residents. They were looking for any sign of Stephen.
When Birch arrived on the scene, he was directed to the vehicle. Inside, there were personal items, clothing, a sleeping bag, a camouflage air rifle. Nearby, a bucket of pecans, and a pecan picking tool. Have you ever seen a pecan picking tool?
Yeah, my grandparents in Millbury used to have pecan trees. And so they had those little tools. Assuming that it's what I'm remembering, it was like almost like a... That handle was like something from like a shovel or some other kind of tool. But it was shorter. And then the bottom had a basket. It was a metal thing. And then it had a basket type, with opening. So that when you put it down, the pecans could fit through the opening. And so you collected it in your little basket and you just sat it down on top of the pecans and it picked them up for you.
Gotcha. About a quarter mile northwest, another bucket was found. This one with tools and paperwork bearing Stephen's name. What's with the buckets?
I don't know.
I mean, that's really weird in itself to me.
Okay, well, the initial report of the vehicle said there was a TV. And I actually think the sleeping bag was like on the top of the car, not actually inside. And so it's almost like, I think like this is part of why Sheriff is so like convinced that this was set up, was that it was made to look like somebody was living there. It's interesting about the bucket of tools because one of the things that we'll get into here shortly is that the last time that Bowman Jr., the dad, said he saw Stephen was when Stephen came to borrow a wrench.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm like, well, okay, well, I'd like to know if that wrench was in there, but I don't know. That was a thought I had today, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure, other than like they just really needed it to look like maybe he was camping out there.
Yeah.
Outside of these things, there was no sign of Stephen himself. Only a story left behind and carefully chosen objects.
And why here? Why not further out? Why go to such great lengths to make it look lived in?
Another interesting thing is that all of the witnesses who saw Stephen between December 26th and December 27th remembered him driving that red Blazer.
What did he normally drive, the Blazer or the station wagon?
Yes, the Blazer. The station wagon, I don't even know if he'd had it a month, quite frankly. He hadn't had it long, put it that way.
Do you remember about the station wagon, where he got it from?
I do not. I mean, I remember stuff about it, but I do not know where he got it from, no.
All of their statements remembered that Blazer, except for one. Tina Bowman, the daughter of James Bowman Jr.
Yeah. Put a pin in that, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the last episode, we talked about all the people that had seen him driving down the road. They'd passed him at intersections, seen him outside their house. All of them saw him in the red Blazer. This is actually the only time I think I've seen any, besides Don Dixon saying that Stephen gave him the paperwork, right. Tina Bowman is the only person that ever mentions the dang station wagon.
Up next, we take you inside the interviews of James Bowman Jr., Big Bowman, and James Bowman III, Little Bowman, the only publicly named persons of interest in Stephen Pearson's disappearance.
So we know from last time that sometime before Christmas Eve, Stephen Pearson signed for a package. It was addressed to a P. Carter at a home on Wheatcroft Road North. But Stephen, trying to be helpful, delivered it to a different address entirely. the Bowman residence, on Wheatcroft Road South.
According to Kathy Grimes, the Grand Bay postmaster, two women, Alicia Carter and Pamela Fisher, came into the post office on December 26th looking for a package they were expecting at the North Wheatcroft address. Grimes checked her records and saw that it had already been signed for by Stephen Pearson. Grimes reached out to him, and what he told her was startling. He said that he delivered the package to James Bowman Jr. and that the Bowmans had later told him that the package contained marijuana, roughly 10 pounds of it.
Stephen went by the Bowmans to make sure they got the package, and he said on the back door or back steps. And then they told him, oh yeah, we got it. It had a bunch of marijuana in it. And he panicked.
And initially they said, we didn't keep it, we burned it. We kept a little bit of it and then we burned it, but it wasn't in that burn pile.
No, and we ultimately got to the end. There was another individual involved with Little Bowman, and they ultimately admitted to selling a lot of it and still had
possession. They did keep some of it.
They did keep some of it, yeah.
It was like in a barn or a shed or something.
There was a shed that Little Bowman lived in back behind the house.
How do you get a package like this and you think, oh, I'm just going to keep it, nobody's going to be looking for it?
Well, again, you know, criminals were super smart, are going to be a lot tougher.
And probably not that worried about it. Did you ever talk to the girls that were looking for it?
Yes, we did a search warrant on their house as well.
You know, I'm actually not sure how they got the weight of it in it, because...
Yeah, I wondered.
I think they recovered a good bit of it, but like, I mean, I'm not sure how they knew how much was in there.
Yeah.
Unless somebody finally... We don't have all the transcripts, so...
So, I'm trying to remember, because, like, we've talked about a lot of different things, and I don't know. We know that, like, the Bowmans, we have our suspicions about the Bowmans, and we know that the package belonged to these other women, but do they know each other?
Well, according to Big Bowman, the women are related to Cooter.
That's right. Because it kind of makes me wonder if maybe the Bowmans really did know about the delivery and just took it anyway. So then they would know how much was in it, you know what I mean?
So said that they had a lot of guns in the house.
Yeah.
That when they asked why they had all those guns, said for protection.
Yeah.
And said that they had had gangs showing up because Little Bowman wasn't paying his drug deals. They showed up basically because they were going to get their money. And so they had all these guns. And so my guess is that they would be at least familiar with each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that would make sense. And with, you know, the kind of family business that they had. I mean,
yeah. Concerned, Grimes accompanied Stephen to the Bowman home that same day. She later told investigators that when she questioned the Bowmans, both Big Bowman and Little Bowman claimed that they had no idea what she was talking about. And Stephen, she said, looked befuddled. Still, he insisted that he delivered the package there and that they had told him it contained drugs.
But that wasn't the end of it. Grimes returned to the post office, but to her surprise, the Bowmans were already there. And this time, they changed their story.
They admitted the package did arrive, and they admitted that it contained marijuana. And they admitted they kept a small quantity for personal use, but claimed they burned the rest.
That admission prompted investigators to act quickly. On January 8, 2001, Sheriff Birch and Sergeant Batiste interviewed Grimes.
Which is where that information came from that we just talked about.
Right.
That same interview.
Right.
Yeah, that's a little confusing on the timeline.
Yeah. Then went straight to the Bowman property,
where they were greeted by a Little Bowman, who agreed to cooperate. He gave a voluntary statement to Bert that mirrored much of what Grimes had reported, but with some new details.
According to the report, Little Bowman said Stephen delivered the package to what he called his future home, a wooden outbuilding behind the main house. The package was opened on Christmas Day by his stepmother, Patricia Kartner. When they realized what was inside, they allegedly panicked.
Little Bowman said Patricia looked at the label and saw it wasn't even addressed to her. It had gone to the wrong house. So they all agreed to destroy it. He claimed his father burned most of it in the front yard burn pile, but kept a small amount for himself.
When asked if he actually saw his father burn the package, Little Bowman said no.
And while that interview was happening, Big Bowman pulled into the driveway. He too was questioned, and his story didn't quite line up.
When pressed on the inconsistencies, Big Bowman agreed to a search of the property. And then something strange happened. He offered to show investigators where he'd stashed the remaining marijuana.
And just for the record, the inconsistencies were about who actually burned the marijuana. Apparently, there was some discrepancies in how this actually occurred.
Right.
So at that point, a nearby patrol deputy arrived to assist. They had, you know, called in for backup. That deputy told Bert that he just happened to be working a separate case that he'd taken a report on that very morning, which is January 8th, regarding unlawful breaking and entering. The suspect, Little Bowman.
He denied it, but the mounting pressure was clear. Still, Bert and Batiste proceeded with the formal interviews at the sheriff's office.
Now, there are unintelligible marks in this, like, parenthesis in the transcript. So, this is one of those things. We don't have the original audio. They're in cassette tape. So, those are going to have to be digitized. They couldn't hear whoever was transcribing, couldn't hear some of the things. So, we have unintelligible in here just because that's what was in the transcript.
Right.
So, according to the January 8th, 2001 interview transcript, Little Bowman recounted the events on Christmas Day, from how he discovered the package and assumed it was something his dad had ordered, to Patricia opening the package. He stated that he knew what it was as soon as he saw it, and when he told Bowman Jr. and Patricia it was weed, his dad said, "Fuck, I've been set up."
Little Bowman went on further. "So at that point, my dad didn't know to either call the cops, dispose of it, or what. So my dad said, well, he'd figured if nobody had it, they couldn't pin nothing on him. Well, he just got rid of it, you know."
Then after a little more explaining, Little Bowman said, my dad showed Steve some of the weed that he took for his personal, which, unintelligible, about an ounce, half ounce, somewhere around there. Unintelligible. But then Bert says, "Okay, when you refer to Steve, is that Steve Pearson?" And Little Bowman says, "Yeah, the man that's missing."
Little Bowman denied anyone being present when Stephen dropped the package off. He stated that his dad and Patricia were out of town, and he claimed that he was at some friend's house. He stated that Stephen wasn't present when the package was opened. When asked how Stephen learned the package contained marijuana, he stated, "Steve came over and said something about, 'Do you know that package? You know, did you get your package?' Because he didn't know if we know it was in the house or not. My dad said, 'Yeah.' And my dad said, there was a bunch of weed in the package." And Steve was like, "What?" And my dad, well, I wasn't here when this conversation went on. This is hearsay. My dad was working on his tractor, and my dad showed him the little bit that he had, you know, that he put up for himself. And Steve was, like, upset, you know? So we blew it off, and then the postmaster came and got Steve. Steve brought it over here. At first, me and my dad denied. You know, we told them that we disposed of it. We didn't say what was in it. The lady started talking about we were going to jail, this, that, and the other. So we went up to the post office and we told the lady the exact same way we told that we're telling you now, that, you know, we burned it. It's disposed of. It's gone. You know, then Mr. Pearson comes up missing. The lady comes over to my house that day, the day that Steve and that post lady came over.
It's worth pointing out that Little Bowman is the one that introduced Stephen Pearson into that conversation by referring to him as Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this point, Stephen's name had not been mentioned by either Bert or Batiste or Little Bowman. He called him Steve throughout that answer.
Yes, he did.
Until it came to the point where he's bringing up that Stephen's gone missing and he shifts to Mr. Pearson. If that's not some distancing language, I don't know what is. Because you assume, like, if his name's Stephen Pearson, you've got people that are calling him Steve, you're obviously going to be on a little bit of a friendly basis. If you're on a first name, let alone a nickname basis, and maybe he introduces himself as Steve. I'm not sure. But he's calling him Steve, which kind of indicates that there's at least a pretty good familiarity with him.
Right.
And then to suddenly swap that to, well, Mr. Pearson comes up missing. Now mm-hmm. It's like, oh, well, we're really not friends. We're not on that first name basis.
Yeah, exactly.
Little Bowman told Bert that he thought Grimes and Steven came by their house around 11 and that he and his dad went to the post office around 5 p.m. And that at some point during all of this, a younger black female on a bicycle stopped by their house questioning him about the package.
He claimed he argued back and forth with her about whether they'd actually burn the package, and then says, so, and the reason my dad didn't call the cops, because my dad's already in trouble. The first thing he thought when he seen the weed was that he was set up. Little Bowman, of course, claimed that when the woman left, he heard her talking on a cell phone, telling someone, yeah, he's got it. And that when he left later that evening, she and two other vehicles followed him. He claimed that they were still following him and that he'd seen them on at least three different occasions, including the night before, January 7th, when he'd went out to a bar with friends.
I thought, well, what kind of trouble is your dad in that you automatically think I'm set up?
Yeah, that is kind of odd. I think that's like
his
when
dad
you're...
does talk about it in his interview. Yeah, not 100% sure that I understand it.
Yeah, it almost is like, what do they say, thou doth it protest too much.
Yeah, well, you know, he, so in his interview he's like, oh, my dad was nervous about this, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll see from Big Bowman's interview that he kind of like shifts that over to Little Bowman.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting to see the dynamics, and it's no wonder there were inconsistencies, honestly.
Yeah. It's almost like they were protecting themselves, but also at the same time throwing each other under the bus.
Yeah. And I kind of think that Little Bowman even said something about his dad being slow. Like, he watches TV and that's why he thought he was being set up. He's a little slow, not well educated, and like watches too much TV, and that's what made him think that he was being set up.
Wow.
It's interesting. When Little Bowman was asked whether he had reported the incidents of people following him to MCSO or any law enforcement agency, Little Bowman said, honestly, I don't want to deal with the sheriff's department or the police. I stay away. I try to keep my nose. I'd rather take care of my business. Don't deal with nobody. That way, if I ain't got to deal with the police, I ain't in trouble by the police. That's my belief. I didn't think nothing like this was going to happen, like with Steve and my sister. I didn't think nothing like this was going to happen, you know. It wasn't, in my opinion, it ain't that much weed. The people, I mean, you see hundreds of pounds coming into the state or hear about it all the time. And 5 pounds, you thinking, you know, that ain't no weed. You know, that's just like somebody's personal you wouldn't think it's worth killing somebody over. And me and my dad, the first thing when he told me Steve was missing, unintelligible, there, I was like, we don't know what else it could have been about, you know? Steve don't do nobody nothing. Steve's one of those people that if you can't get along with Steve, you can't get along with nobody.
In one of the interviews with Little Bowman, he admitted to giving a large quantity of marijuana to a friend known as Big Pun and agreed to contact him.
Birch and Batiste questioned Big Bowman later that day. His tone was less structured, but no less telling.
He claimed he joked about the package, set Patricia up to open it, and said she started unwrapping it like it was a game. But when they realized what it was, he panicked. He told the investigators, I said, I'm being framed now. And that was the first thing that came to my mind.
He then rambled about Mississippi. There were some unintelligibles in that. Something about crazy shit going on. That they were trying to set him up for whatever was happening in Mississippi. It was a little disjointed and a little hard to follow. I'm not sure what crazy shit was going on or who they were.
I was just going to say, who is they? But then when asked who came by to confront him, he said Stephen did. And when Stephen learned what was in the package, Bowman Jr. said Stephen got frisky, that he seemed scared.
So he says he came by the house. And he asked me, did you see the package? I didn't know, unintelligible. I said, yeah, I got a package. And I said, well, yeah, I brought it over here. That's what he told me. I said, yeah, you know, that package you had, well, you brought over here, you know what was in that thing? Marijuana. A whole big old little block of it. Well, he got kind of, you know, frisky about it then. And I said, well, I burned it, you know, I burnt it. And he said, all right, no problem. Then he left. And then he came back with a, you know, the mail lady. Well, I forget. And then Birch was like, the postmaster? Postmaster. I ain't got the package. I burned it. Now what I'm going to do? That's what I'm saying to myself. And I just try to blow it off, you know. And, well, she said, I'll just get investigators into it. And then she left. And I say, hey, Steve, where, intelligible from you, you know, to keep him there, to find out what's going on. You know, I'm in a bind. He's in a bind. Everybody's in a bind now. He brought me a package. He didn't even know what the hell it was. I didn't know what the hell it was. Nobody knew what it was until we opened it. And now we're in big shit. I meant, excuse me, we're in trouble. And that's what we done. Then we went up there today to the postmaster and told him. So when they circled him back and asked him to clarify what he meant about Stephen being frisky, he stated he was kind of, I don't know, I can't even describe it. He didn't act the same. It seemed like he was, you know, he feared something. I don't know what. And when he's like that, I know something's going down. I don't know what, unintelligible, talking. And after that, he came back. And then when I talked to him, when the postmaster went back, when me and him talked about the, you know, well, the weed. There's some words missing here, guys. And I don't know if the transcript was missing or what happened here. But when me and him talked about the, you know, well, the weed, goes, well, just go, unintelligible, tell the truth. And while you're doing that, I'm going to go, you know, unintelligible, some kind of check. He was talking about, said, I'm going to go take care of that. Then, after you just go on over there and tell them the truth, what you done. And I said, all right. He said he going to verify it, you know. He going to come back and go over there and verify what I said. And that's all it is. And that's all. And then all this kind of stuff came up. Unintelligible man. So, then, at some point in all of this, Big Bowman has relayed to Birch and Batiste that the last time he saw Stephen was when Stephen stopped by their house to borrow a wrench. So Birch asked him, so the last time you saw Steve was when he left your house, when he asked to borrow a wrench. And Big Bowman says, that's the last time I seen him. Birch clarifies, after the postmaster. And Big Bowman says, after the postmaster. So he's admitted that he's seen Stephen now after this visit with the postmaster.
Right.
To borrow a wrench.
Huh. After the postmaster, huh?
Yeah. Like, this is after, and there is part in, it's a little bit, this is some more of that conflicting information, right? Because now Big Bowman has said, Stephen stopped by to borrow a wrench. Well, then Little Bowman actually says something like his dad had actually borrowed a wrench from Stephen, and he'd been trying to go and give it back over the last few days. So they give very conflicting information on, like, what's going on with this wrench.
Right.
On top of everything else. And so then he also tells them that he'd been followed. And that the night before his interview, the same night that Little Bowman was out at a bar and claimed to have been followed, he went to the bar that Little Bowman was at to tell him to keep his mouth shut and don't say a damn thing, don't do nothing, leave shit alone. And so when they asked what he was concerned about Little Bowman talking about, Big Bowman claimed that Little Bowman would make big things out of small things. He'd get carried away and just run his mouth. And then Birch asked Big Bowman if he recalled talking to several individuals at Stephen's residence on January 7th. Big Bowman said, yeah. So Birch asked him about a conversation that he'd had with Elaine Bearden, where he stated he'd seen a checkbook on the seat of the blue station wagon. And Big Bowman denied telling anybody he saw a checkbook on the station wagon and claimed that he was told that information by a Mobile County Sheriff's Office deputy. Big Bowman actually denied knowing that Stephen even had a blue station wagon.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Birch ended up contacting the deputy about this conversation, and the deputy confirmed he did actually have a conversation with Big Bowman, but he denied telling Big Bowman anything about a checkbook being on the front seat or even disclosing what kind of vehicle was actually in the woods.
Hmm.
And so, continuing on with this interview, Big Bowman was asked about an incident that had occurred earlier in the day at the Bowman residence when Birch and Batiste had initially stopped by.
So, this is how the interview went. Batiste, why is your son so concerned about going to jail after the unintelligible, after he found the marijuana? Why was he so concerned about going to jail? Bowman, I don't know. Batiste, he got extremely upset with you out there in the yard after he got the marijuana. Bowman, I ain't got no idea. I couldn't tell you. I don't know. Batiste, does he have any other cases pending? Bowman, well, he got that incident long ago. You know, three bad ones? Batiste, yeah, I noticed that. Is he on probation for anything? Bowman, not that I know of. Batiste, not that you know of. Bowman, not that I know of. Batiste, okay. He made a statement out there in the yard. You know what's going to happen now if I go to jail. What was he talking about? Bowman says, this is a federal offense. A federal offense. That's what he's talking about. A federal. He ain't got no. We never told you this was a federal offense, Batiste says. Bowman says, no, that's what he's saying, because, you know, it'd be on TV or, you know, prosecuting unintelligible. Batiste says, so that's why he was upset? Bowman, yeah. Batiste, okay. Bowman, I don't think he did that. No, I don't think so. And Birch interjects, you don't think he did what? Bowman, no, I don't think so. Batiste, you don't think he did what? Bowman, kill anyone. Batiste, you don't think... Bowman interrupts, I don't think he would. Birch now interjects again, do you know why he would make several references to Stephen Pearson being murdered? thumb and says, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't hear that. I don't know nothing about that. What are you talking about? I don't even understand what you're saying.
No one had asked about a murder, but the name Stephen Pearson kept coming up. And it sounds like in the context of being murdered.
And both Bowman seemed to believe what happened to him was directly tied to the package. So, you know, there seems to be some consensus among Bowman's that he might have been murdered.
Yeah, and I could understand if they have somebody show up at their house, right, and they're asking about this package, and I think Little Bowman and the woman who showed up, according to Little Bowman anyway, got into somewhat of a heated argument about this package. I think she even told him, like, you look stoned.
Mm.
You know where my package is. And he's like, we burn it up. We don't have it. We burnt it up. I don't think he's the one that said that. I'm not sure. But anyway, he tells her, like, we don't have it. I think he actually told her, you can go dig it out of that ash pile if you want to. And so he admits, like, in his interview that he was being a little bit of a smartass and had an attitude with her. And so I can see where they would have, if that's happened, right? The people have come to them and they're like, we're getting this package back one way or another, which mm-hmm. I think is something that he said she told him. They could use that to form a logical assumption that the people looking for the package could have had something to do with it. But then you go back and you're like, well, nobody said that he's murdered or there's anything to even indicate that he's been murdered.
Well, not to mention the fact that he doesn't currently possess the package. So why would they murder him over that?
Right. And that the fact that Big Bowman up there says, we're all in big shit.
Yeah.
You know, like he's in a bind. Steven's in a bind. Everybody's in a bind. What does that mean?
Right.
You're not in a bind if you just tell the truth.
Right. Right.
Since Bowman Jr. didn't seem entirely sure what would have made Little Bowman nervous about jail, we ran both Bowman's names through Alabama court records, Alicorp, Pacer, anything we could get our hands on.
What we found was mixed. To start with, interestingly, Bowman Jr. didn't really have a criminal record to speak of.
Big Bowman's record revealed fairly minor things in context to what could arguably be called a family business. We found nuisances such as speeding tickets, fishing/tramping without a license, and one harassment charge in 2018. And of course, the possession of marijuana first degree that will come from this package.
And then there's Little Bowman. His record was a bit more colorful.
James K. Bowman III, a.k.a. Little Bowman, a.k.a. Spider, has a record that includes multiple arrests for traffic violations, possession, unlawful manufacturing, including a 2006 federal charge for possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine, and at least one out-of-state theft charge, where he was picked up here on a fugitive from justice.
Not so innocent.
No.
Well, I guess not that either of them really are innocent, but on paper, not so innocent.
Right. They get charged with the drug, like half possession, right? Intent to distribute. Do you think that would be enough to kill somebody, though? Like, how long would they have been looking at jail-wise?
I mean, in their minds, you know, you see the word trafficking.
Yeah,
you know, you're thinking a long, long time, and, yeah. And theoretically, you know, trafficking cocaine, you know, might get you 10, 15 years. Trafficking marijuana, probably not, you know,
yeah.
3 to 5 years. But Bowman, Big Bowman, had no criminal record whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I think he was terrified at the thought of going to jail. And I say that because when we told him they were going to jail, he basically got in a fetal position and was crying and so afraid of going to jail. And so if you look at it in the sense that, okay, Stephen just came and told us that he went and reported us to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Now we've got a problem. And, you know, we're going to eliminate that problem.
But wouldn't they be creating more problems for him? Like, that's a long
I never try to speculate on how a criminal's mind works. there are a lot of cases through the years that, you know, if you eliminate a witness, you know, sometimes it's not much of a case.
Both Big Bowman and Little Bowman were arrested on January 8, 2001, and charged in connection with the package of marijuana they received. Both Bowmans were initially charged with trafficking. However, it was determined that there were insufficient facts to support that charge, and the warrants were issued for possession of marijuana first degree.
So, coming up, what Tina Bowman told investigators about the last time she saw Stephen. She's the only witness who claims to have seen him driving the Impala. If you have any information about Stephen Pearson's case, you can call or text 251-501-2653. We've set up Extension 3 as a dedicated tip line specifically for tips related to Stephen Pearson's disappearance. If you have questions or comments about anything you've heard in this episode, feel free to email us at info@alcoldcase.com. Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Red Circle to your favorite podcast platforms. Content, research, artwork, and production are by Sellers and Stormy of Alabama Cold Case Advocacy. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and research sources can be found in each episode's description. Your support helps us continue producing Unforgotten and further Alabama Cold Case's mission of advocacy and awareness. There are a few ways you can help us light the path. Make a one-time or monthly donation to Unforgotten through Red Circle. Sign up for a one-time or recurring donation through the ACCA website. Or subscribe to the Unforgotten Patreon channel for early access to ad-free episodes. You will find the links for all three in our episode descriptions. Another cost-free way to be of great help is to follow us on social media. But most importantly, whatever you do, tell everyone you know about these cases. Sharing their stories is one of the most effective ways to help find resolution for Alabama's cold cases. Be the spark. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
That was good. You did good on that one.
Thanks.